irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
What's going on?
You got a haircut. You definitely.
No, I didn't.
You didn't? I think
no,
you did.
I didn't get a haircut. Last haircut I got was in July.
Well, that was only 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, it was a week, the last week of July, but I've done this show since then. I've seen you since then.
You wear a hat all the time.
I've seen you since then.
Well, good to see you. All groomed and snappy.
I'm trying to finish a text right now.
Oh, so what's your text?
It's just
is it a dirty text?
Yeah, I'm trying to. I was going to do a dick pic, but I'm in here with a guest right now. I can't really.
Might be inappropriate.
Yeah, it could be.
Did you see the eclipse yesterday?
I saw down my kid's school.
They you said skid. Down.
My skid school. My skid cool. And one of the parents bought his entire classroom glasses, like all the kids'
That's
glasses.
That's awesome.
So we went down there and around 10:30 and watched it.
What'd you think?
Yeah.
It was kind of meh.
I don't know. I saw one when I was in grade school. It's like, I don't know.
I saw one when I was in grade school, and I also thought it was meh back then. The only difference was I actually saw it through glasses this time. I didn't see it through glasses.
Oh, I didn't see it through glasses last time.
So how did you do it? Because I think the way we did it on paper. It was like
we did it with that. You make a shoe box, and then the hole, and you watch in the box, and you see the hole cover up.
Yep. We did it with paper. Somehow they did it with the same kind of thing, but the paper, you looked at the paper for the
Did you have glasses this
eclipse?
Time?
I actually just borrowed somebody's real quick, but I drove all over LA County for glasses just to see if I could find some, and dude, nobody had any. I'm like, dude,
It was like the end thing to do.
But you know what? A lot of businesses could have made a lot of money on those had they just like.
I heard at one point they were charging like $25.
Yeah.
A pair for just cheap paper glasses.
I know. But the crazy thing was, I didn't, you know, I wasn't, I had friends that drove to Idaho and Oregon and flew to Oregon.
Well, Oregon, I think it would have been cool if you were where it was like, when it went full totality, where it went dark.
Yeah, but it's only like 3 minutes.
That would have been interesting to be in that, but I mean, whatever.
I don't know if I would have flown all the way.
Oh, I wouldn't have put any money into it. If I happened to have been living there or within a 20-mile radius, I would have driven there, but like.
But it would have been so crazy. Well, if you were living there, you could just walk out your door and it's there. Yeah. Then it'd be cool. But a lot of people were like saying it was like an out-of-body experience. It was amazing.
Those people are idiots.
And I just didn't have that experience.
I am fully aware how insignificant and small we are in the universe. So it doesn't blow my mind when huge celestial events occur.
Right.
Like, it's like, I totally am aware of that, so it's
well, I mean, the crazy thing is I saw images on TV that were more impressive than what I saw.
Well, yeah, NASA's definitely going to take a better picture than what I can see through the $5 pair of glasses.
But it was actually also cool to see the totality, the darkness in, like, Nashville and Kentucky and some of those places.
That would have been interesting to be in, but at the same time, I don't think it was, like, some amazing.
Yeah, it was definitely overhyped.
I wasn't going to be amazed by it before going into it.
So. See, I went in with low expectations, but then I saw it and I was like, I saw it only for like maybe 5 seconds. That's cool.
I just borrowed my kid's glasses, looked at it. It looked like a little like black crescent moon on the sun.
Yeah.
I'm like, all right.
And it was red when I was looking at it. So I don't know. It could have been the glasses. I don't know. Who knows? But it was kind of
put that much thought into it.
Yeah, but I was like, I'm 38, so I was like, am I becoming a Grinch? Like,
No, because I was in grade school and I wasn't that impressed. I remember being in grade school.
That's
like,
I felt then. Oh. But I mean, it was way more hyped this time around. And
I've
love
seen
like
meteor showers. I'm like, oh, okay.
I've seen meteor showers in
Alaska. And I'm
and you thought that was just meh.
I was like, meh.
See, like, I think that would be cooler than what everybody thought the eclipse was.
Probably.
Meteor but showers, I think, are cool.
I look at them like, that's pretty, and then I'm done. It's like, I don't...
Yeah. Well, that's how I was with the eclipse. I was like, yeah, that's cool. All right, moving on. And that's that.
But I did not lose my crap about it.
Like, no, a lot of people did. A lot of people... And I was like, man, I was like, I kind of felt bad. I was like, dude, I feel like I'm losing the smelling of the roses in life if I can't see something. No. Well, that happens once in 20 years, and then I'm still like, meh.
But what's it... What's it supposed to do? I mean, it's just there, then it's done, and then you move on.
Yeah, I guess it was it was not as significant as I thought.
Everything, every day in life is a once-in-a-lifetime event. Like, no day is exactly the same.
And the best is they're like, the next one's 2045. I mean, 2024. I mean, 2019.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's happening sooner than anybody thinks. So it's, you know, it's just kind of funny. But how was your week?
Oh, that was it.
That your whole week was for the eclipse?
I prepped for the eclipse the whole week.
Did you see Donald Trump look at it with his bare eyes?
I don't want to talk about that.
Okay, all right. Have you seen the movie Suicide Squad? My session's got canceled today. Man, that movie was terrible. I didn't even understand how that movie could be made. I had a day off today, and I was like,
I see how it could be made, because it's a cool concept for an idea to get a bunch of bad guys, force them to be good guys.
None of it was believable. And what they did is they made the mistake of
going, like, taking what could have been a cool character-driven superhero movie, and what they should have done is follow the Deadpool formula and make it small and make it about the characters, make it something happening there. But instead, they put the characters together and then made it some sort of, like...
ulterior plot.
Well, no, some, like, huge, like, extinction-level event that they have to prevent.
What are you, Dr. Seuss over here?
No, but I'm just saying, but that's what they're trying to do. And then, like, that takes away from, like, what could have been a great dynamic between all these interesting characters. Because, like, if the world's going to end, then, like, where's Wonder Woman? Where's Superman? Where's Batman?
But the thing is, it's like, they had such a killer cast.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you got Oscar winners, you have huge names, and then you just have such a shitty movie.
Because they didn't make it about the characters. They went big with it. They were trying to make it like, oh, this thing's going to destroy the world. We got to just make it about...
I was like, I watched this movie, and I was like, I know Eddie hated this movie. Not even 30 minutes.
Because I read Suicide Squad as a kid. It was one of my favorite comic books. It was a great kind.
You must have been really disappointed.
And Deadshot is one of my favorite DC comic book heroes or villains.
Well,
or
okay, then so did anybody pull off the character?
No.
Yeah, that's kind of what I gathered too.
Not at all.
But I didn't know the comics at all.
It's the whole DC universe just sucks.
Well, I mean, that movie was...
The film version.
That movie had like a crazy budget though. Like, that's what's nuts. I'm like, you know, they could do something clever and simple and make it awesome without some of the special effects.
Save extinction-level events for Superman, for Wonder Woman, for Batman, for the big characters that have to save the planet. Don't make Suicide Squad have to save the planet.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
And also, the cameos with Batman in it, I thought, were like, meh.
Well, they're just trying to link everything together,
but you're trying to do too much. That whole movie, they were trying to do too much the entire time.
Because they're trying to catch up to Marvel. Marvel took years to build to get where it is.
Yeah.
2008 with Iron Man. They started going separate. Oh, everybody got their own movie, and then they brought them all together. They're doing this. They had Man of Steel, and then they all of a sudden they did Batman vs. Superman and Wonder Woman, now Justice League. So now they're trying to cram all this in.
Did you see Wonder Woman?
Yeah.
Like, Wonder Woman I thought was good.
It was good. It's the best one out of all of them.
But,
you know.
But, man, I had high hopes for Suicide Squad, but everybody said it sucked. So I was like, okay, I'm going to wait till it comes out. And then I just watched it, and I was like, man, I cannot
believe. Had they just done, like, a small plot and just dealt with, like, the dynamic of bringing all these villains together to try to do something good would have been interesting.
Do you think they ever, like, ask comic book nerds that, like, what do you think of
this? No, because it's all written. They have 75 years of written material that they don't use. They don't even reference
the fans. Like, you know, I was just thinking, like, something, if they just asked fans what they thought of this plot, fans would be like, that's awesome. Or they would just say, no.
Like, here's an example. So like, dumb. Ant-Man they did with the Marvel did Ant-Man, which was, it's not a great movie. It's an entertaining movie. But, and what happened was the plot of that movie, of course, had the Yellow Jacket had to succeed in his plot, it could have been something like extinction level, like take over the world level stuff. But they kept it small enough in the movie where you didn't feel like, well, this would alarm Iron Man and Captain America and everybody else to come jump into this.
Right.
Ant-Man took care of the small thing before it got out of hand.
But it was also like the
backstory. So it worked in that universe.
Yeah. No, I agree.
But this making it this big thing where half the city's getting destroyed, I mean, Wonder Woman's going to show up.
And I also think, like, the backstory. Backstory is very important for characters.
Well, you're also trying to tell the backstory of, like, seven different people.
Doesn't matter. If you have seven different people and you just spend 2 minutes on each one, there's no movie there. I mean, it's just too many characters, you know what I mean? So I just thought it was like a waste of a great cast, a waste of a crazy budget, waste of special effects. It was
because, like, you're trying to do backstory of like seven characters in one movie. You can't. Like, that's why Iron Man had a movie, Thor had a movie, Captain America had a movie, like, and then all of a sudden you see him in the Avengers, like, this works because I don't have to worry about all the backstory. We know where everyone came from and now they're here.
So you think they should have split it up?
Yeah, but you can't do it with those characters because no one's going to go see a, you know, Deadshot movie.
Or maybe. Never know. Mm. You never know. But I couldn't wait to talk to you about that because, man, I love
it's bouncing. Only a year and a half late.
Well, I mean, you know, I just wanted time to, like, die down because everybody said they hated the movie so much. So
terrible.
I was just like, I'm going to wait.
Horrible.
Anyways, looks like our special guest has arrived, Mr. Fernando Perdomo. Wait, I said that wrong. I added an R.
That's
all
right.
Fernando Perdomo.
Perdomo.
Did I say that right?
That's fine.
See? No, it's not fine. My name's Nikhil Carullo. Leo, people butcher that all day.
Leo and night. August.
What's Leo August?
It was the name I almost changed my name to because I was tired of people overpronouncing my name.
Why'd you pick Leo August?
I don't know. I guess I was born in August.
Leos are born in August?
I don't know.
Or Leo's born in July and August,
most
right?
Most of them are August.
It's like the beginning, first 2 weeks of August or 3 weeks of August.
Well, Fernando and I met a long time ago. We both played the Sunset Sessions. Do you remember that?
God, I miss it.
Dude, that was a fun and crazy. I don't know what your situation is going into the actual Sunset Sessions was, but we flew in and we all got split up because it was the Chinese New Year parade.
Yeah, I remember that.
And it was like walking into a Jackie Chan movie. The band was all split up. Everybody was at all different corners. We couldn't cross into the hotel where we had to play. And then at the last minute, we all just met up. It was one of the craziest gigs I've ever done.
Yeah, a couple members of my band flew in literally right before, and it was a really incredible, chaotic event. But I've met so many incredible people through that, and it was a life-changing thing. That all I could say about Sunset Sessions is there needs to be more,
right?
Because these days it seems so hard to be an independent artist. Success just seems like the farthest thing from reality. And what was really cool is the fact that we were put in rooms with people that were the gatekeepers.
Right.
And they were giving opportunities for us to meet these people that could change our lives. And you know what? I mean, the success thing, as if you have a wide enough definition of it, you'll be happy. And my definition of success is continuing to do what I do and having inspiration to do what I do, whether I'm selling, you know, 30 records or 30,000 records. It doesn't matter because I'm really, really happy doing what I do. And it was great to get that feedback from people that could change your life, and people from major labels and people, major industry professionals,
radio stations.
It was incredible, and I miss it. So, Michelle, bring it back. I think there's talks about them.
Wait, so it's not even happening anymore?
It hasn't been happening for a few years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, but Michelle's gone into a different world of doing retreats to Tulum. I think she's based out of Mexico now.
Oh, yeah.
But she's talking about doing a 20th anniversary Sunset Sessions. I'm just hoping it's not in Mexico. No offense against Mexico. I toured there enough in the 2000s. You know, it's a cool place, but Bring it to San Diego.
Did you get kidnapped?
Again.
Do you want to talk about it?
I didn't get kidnapped, but I had some interesting things happen to me down there. But, you know, it's all good. I don't have anything on my record.
So, Eddie, Sunset Sessions is, there's a radio promoter named Michelle Clark, and she was like a big radio promoter for a long time, and she would organize these kind of retreats for all the program directors and radio stations and labels to basically have a weekend. And artists would fly in from all over.
It's almost like a music festival.
It's like a music festival, except it was like totally private. It was like an industry mixer, but it was just like the core people. It was like artists and the people. So it was kind of an amazing experience.
Cut out all those annoying fans.
Yeah, you cut out all you cut. Well, not the
all
fans.
Those people like music.
No, but I mean, it's like you like really get to the people that are the mountain movers.
People just stare at you when you play.
That's
the people you want to play.
And some incredible headliners too. So it was really, really cool.
I think Brett Denton was the big headliner.
Brett Denton was the headliner the night we played.
Yeah,
And it was just Dido played as well.
That's right. I didn't see her. Did you see her?
She was incredible. She was absolutely incredible. And John Hyatt was the...
So you went the whole weekend.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
so that's why it's so chaotic
for
me.
Every year I went, I was there for every panel I could possibly make. I remember that's the first time I heard Foxygen. They had a song panel, and I was one of the few people that liked it. And some of the comments from the radio people was, you know, this band is not going to do anything. This is one of the worst submissions we've ever heard. And, you know, they sold out a couple nights at the Fonda, and now they're going to play the Greek.
That's crazy.
You know, you never know, because that's the thing. They're constantly evolving face of music these days, where, you know, bands that are as DIY and lo-fi as Foxygen and the Lemon Twigs can become super famous, and then people are starting to shun the auto-tuned, beat-corrected, programmed world. You know, I'm so glad that I'm hearing less and less programming on music these days, and people are actually playing their instruments. And that's coming back. And I started seeing that a little bit with Sunset Sessions, where there was more real music that was being made, as opposed to where I'm from. I'm from Miami Beach, Florida, where it's all EDM, auto-tuned.
Yeah, it's the Ultra, you know, where the Ultra Festival is, right?
Yeah,
but it's
Ultra,
just cyclical, though, right?
And thank you. You know, hold on. This is important. Thank you for saying.
Yeah,
the
Eddie,
Ultra.
Hold on.
Thank you for saying. No, I need to capitalize on something you just said. Thank you for saying the Ultra Festival, not the Ultra Music Festival, because that was one of the most maddening things being a musician in Miami and having this thing claim to be a music festival and, number one, not have any local acts, number two, DJs, no live musicians, barely any live musicians. If you had a guy with a keyboard playing the tracks, that was the closest thing.
Right.
So I'm glad that the world is going back to organic, you know, because, hey, I mean, look, EDM, it is art, it is music, but when it comes down to it, you know, it needs to be, there needs to be some more respect towards people that are actually doing what they do.
Yep, I agree. You know? I agree. Eddie, what you were saying?
I was just saying it's cyclical, though. I mean, like, the synthesized program music comes, and then it has its ride, and music comes back, and then it just keeps going. I mean, it's just a cyclical thing.
I was thinking about that, but I was, like, listening to some 80s, like new age, not new age, kind of like new order, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure like classic rock musicians or rock and roll musicians, when they were hearing that come out, they were like, oh, music's gone to shit, the synthesized stuff. And then it's just evolved. Like it's got its own evolution.
Yeah, but like it got like the 80s, it got really over synthesized. Yeah. And then when came grunge came in, it just stripped everything away.
Yeah.
However, one of the big differences between the electronic music of the 80s and the electronic music today is that there was song structure.
Mm-hmm.
And the proof is in the pudding. You take a New Order song and you strip it down to acoustic, it's still a song.
Yeah, I agree.
If I sat here and played you a Tiesto or any of those guys, DJ, whatever, Left Nut, you know, if you play these songs, you know, they're not songs. They're just chopped up hooks and repeated 80,000 times. And, you know,
but isn't that music born out of the dance club areas, yeah, anyways, where that works? And then some people have just taken it.
Well, there's a thing with
to
it.
Listen, I mean, to it, yeah, outside, I mean, of a dance club, which I don't know why you would.
There's definitely a vibe. I mean, I think millennials respond more to it, mostly because when they're born into the world, they're messing with the iPod touches and the iPad touches, and there is some connection to technology and music being born out of that. I understand that, but I also hear where you're coming from. There's a respect to a musician that takes 20 years to learn his craft, and that sometimes gets taken for granted. And same with comedians, Eddie, you know this. It's like, it's one of these kind of like lost arts. Like, you see people shoot up to success because they're using things like YouTube or, you know, tweeting as a vehicle.
Well, they just become famous in a different medium than
but that's
performing in a comedy club.
Well, Fernando, let's go way back. What was the thing that made you want to become a musician?
The Beatles.
What was the song?
It was a, you know, that's a good, I never pinpointed the song. It was a general atom bomb that went off when I saw it, when I first got exposed to the Beatles. It had to do a lot with a cassette tape I bought in a flea market called 20 Greatest Hits. And I guess Let It Be, a lot of the, you know, Paul McCartney and Wings stuff, like Maybe I'm Amazed. These are the things that's like, okay, I got to do this. Yeah. Paul McCartney was an early, an early idol when it came to a template. You know, okay, this guy, he plays all the instruments, he writes great songs, he's a musician's musician, he's a respected musician, respected songwriter, and a hell of a performer. That's great. And then I found this guy, Todd Rundgren, who's similar but takes it to the next level because he's more of a producer. And I was like, oh, man, I want to be behind the scenes. I want to be on stage behind the scenes, you know, doing all this music stuff, playing all this different genres of style of music. So I've always set my bar really high because these are guys that are considered to be almost space alien. Like,
yeah.
You know, they can do no wrong. And I'm not perfect. I'm not the greatest guitar player, not the greatest singer, but damn it, I love making music, and I hope the joy is heard in this recordings and whenever I play. And it goes back to being obsessed with the Beatles when I was 6, being obsessed with King Crimson when I was 9, being obsessed with Tori Amos when I was in high school, you know. And I still get obsessed with things. Like right now, I'm obsessed with the first 3 Steely Dan records.
I love Steely Dan.
I love Steely Dan when they were a band. See, Becker and Fagan, after a while, they jettisoned Skunk Baxter and Jim Hodder and Denny Diaz and decided to get a bunch of shirt-tucked-in jazz musicians. So all that, like, Gaucho Asia stuff, Royal Scam, great. It's awesome, but it's a different band. Can't Buy a Thrill, Countdown to Ecstasy, Pretzel Logic, those 3 records and the tours and all the bootlegs, they were a band working together, and it's so cool. I mean, it really is incredible.
I got a little Steely Dan trivia. Can you name the only drummer that's played on a whole Steely Dan album from beginning to end?
Yeah, because that's right. On Katie Lied, it was Porcaro played everything but Hal Blaine. The only drummer to play, is it... Oh, it's Jim Hodder.
Keith Carlock.
Jim Hodder played all the drums on Can't Buy a Thrill.
No, I think there's one track that he's not playing drums on.
On Can't Buy a Thrill?
Mm-hmm. We'll have to check that. And he's like,
if only we had mini computers in our hands.
Jim Hodder played on everything on the first record. I'm pretty damn sure.
We'll have to check. This will have to come back.
I'd have to do a little bet.
Well, let's do this. Let's get into one of your songs right now. What are you going to play us first?
I'm going to play the first single off the record. It's called Here With Me. And just released a video for it, and I'm really proud of it. Cindy Tressel did an incredible video for it, and it's an end times love song. Stars shine in your eyes. Love exists tonight. If this is the last night of my life, it wouldn't be a tragedy, 'cause you're here with me. Yeah, you're here with me. Kiss on your lips. Proves that love exists. If this is the last night of my life, a tragedy, because you're here with me. Yeah, you're here with me. If this is the last night of my life, it wouldn't be a tragedy, because
Studio audience loves it. Very nice. So you just finished. How many records is this for you now?
This is technically my third solo album. I had a band called Dreaming in Stereo that was the old vehicle for my songs, and then I moved out here and I've done three solo albums and one compilation. This is the third one, and this was the first record I made outside of my studio. This was actually recorded at Arden Studios in Memphis, which is a very famous studio, one of the most famous studios in Memphis aside from Sun and Stax. This is where all the big star records were made. Led Zeppelin 3 was mixed there.
I didn't know that. That's
ZZ
crazy.
Top, all the ZZ Top records, REM's Green, all the Evanescence records, all the Three Doors Down records. And what's cool about that studio is I got to use all of the same gear that all those bands used, including the original Mellotron, the original piano, the original one of the original guitars from Big Star, the original amps that they used to use, and it was all recorded through the same channels that Led Zeppelin 3 was mixed.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
And it was an incredible thing. It was just the magic of that room. I believe that the dead stay in rooms, and I feel like I felt a good presence there.
You know what? I definitely believe in that too, and it's a dying art form, unfortunately, because studios are closing left and right. And I still love that feeling of walking into an old studio and you feel all those ghosts. You know what I mean? Like, I definitely believe in that too.
I have a home studio and I love it. I'm very proud of it. But this was a great opportunity for me to go to a place that I was out of my comfort zone and inhibited and just inspired. And just sitting there and breathing the air and looking around, I felt like I was meant to be there, and there was a purpose, and there was a mission to make this record, and it's been great. And this, I've done three records there now, because I also produced an artist named Kate Brennan, and we did a record called Third. She got picked up by Omnivore Records, and now we have another one that's going to be coming out later on this year or early next year that's already in the can. And working there is a breeze. I worked with Adam Hill, who is the archivist for Big Star, and he also engineered some of their recordings, and It was a dream. It was just great.
How many rooms do they have there?
They have three, but I recorded in the A room. I recorded in the famous Big Star, you know, REM, ZZ Top room. And
now the big question, did you do it to digital or did you do it analog?
Did it to digital. Doing it to analog is maybe my next record. I would love to do it to analog, but working as a one-man band, I played every instrument on it. It's easier for me to just build it in Pro Tools.
Yeah.
However, I didn't do any auto-tuning and I didn't do any beat detecting. I generally work in Pro Tools because it's just convenient, and I'm just I wanted to be in my comfort zone when I took the tracks back out to Reseda Ranch Studios and put it together, you know, and then added elements, and it's so much easier. I've read so many horror stories about tape being erased and transferring tape and flying with tape, and we are very fortunate to live in 2017 where an entire record could be done technically for free, because you don't have to buy tape, you don't have to do all the maintenance on the machine, and just one reel of 2-inch is only half an hour.
Right.
So you'd need more than one to make a record. So
yep.
That's an instant $400 investment that you'd have to make. You know, so it keeps costs down, and I think digital's come a long way. I love it, actually. I mean, I'm very happy with Pro Tools. I hated ADATs. I hated the A88s, but Pro Tools is a warm sound to me, and you could get a great sound out of it.
I made Ed, you know, mix some live footage of my band a long time ago.
Oh.
And he was like, man, is this what you do when you make a record? Because this is terrible.
It's awful. It's awful.
Eddie, you hated it.
Oh, hey, I'm not a sound mixer.
No, but I mean,
it's a video editor.
Like, it's crazy because it's like you take so much detail in sound. Like, when you're an artist, too, making music, you take so many different approaches to like balancing things. Yeah, I can just see you going crazy. Like,
well, it's like I'm just like I have like a normal ear, like a person that just listens to music because right. I like music. I don't love music. I don't create music, so I don't hear everything that you guys would hear. So right. I'm sitting there going like, that sounds fine to me. Well, that's fine. Why are you changing that? That was perfect. And yeah. That's the way I think. Like, 98% of the people listening to music have that ear. They're
and like, you know what? The funny thing is, it's like.
But it's the artist that hears and goes, no, yes, that's not right.
Yeah, and
that's
you know not what? Right. I know, Fernando, you probably can relate to this. There's a sense of that's where we will, like, you go down a rabbit hole, and when you're making a record and you kind of obsess over levels or sounds or textures or the feels of things, and it's like this fine line of like, this feels good or this needs work, we need to redo it again. You know what I mean? Do you wrestle with that? Because every record, it's like going into the trenches for me.
I produce a lot of records, and I work with a lot of different artists, and some of them are more pickier than others, and I believe in a good happy medium between I guess later Steely Dan and earlier Steely Dan, you know, where it's like I heard about the I'm reading books on Steely Dan right now, and they're talking about, you know, recording with 40 different bands to try to get it right, having 40 different guys do a solo, you know, cutting tape and trying to get snare drums in time on tape. And you know what? That's all good and dandy. But I was just having a conversation with someone today about Neil Young. There's a jazz musician in Miami that was bad-mouthing Neil Young because he's sloppy. But you know what? Yes, he's sloppy. But man, sex is sloppy. You know, sometimes it's like, you know.
Especially when Eddie does it.
If you do it right, you know, it's sloppy. Like,
there's lots of things in life that's sloppy.
Yeah.
And, you know, if things were just too clean, it would be boring, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it also takes that moment out of that song when you take, I mean, if you do it, like we were saying earlier, like every day is a one-in-a-lifetime moment, and that recording of that music would be that recording of that music.
Mm-hmm.
If you sit there and you tweak it and tweak it, tweak it, you're creating something else.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you know, as a huge Beatles fan, there's full pages about Beatles errors, like, you know, double tracking issues, like, you know, there's a bad punch in, you know, you know, like, those Beatles records aren't perfect, but man, they captured
but they're perfect.
So much soul. Yeah, you know, perfection doesn't have to be perfect.
The first record I did, I got to meet Paul McCartney and watch him record.
Whoa.
Yeah, I was he was doing Chaos and Creation in the backyard.
Oh my God.
And it was life-changing because I saw, like, how he let go of things. He'd track a bass, you know, bass line and be like, all right, that's cool. And Nigel was producing, Nigel Goodrich, who did Radiohead. And he was like, oh, do you want to listen to it? And he's like, nope. And I was like, all right, that's awesome. Like, that he just knows, like, when it's, you know, and it kind of showed me, like, as you make records and you kind of get seasoned, you get those instincts, and those instincts get strengthened. And, like, I'm kind of taking more of that approach now because you see people like that, and you're like, okay, they got to a point where they didn't doubt their instincts. It just got to a point where they could hear it, they could feel it, they knew it was right, move on, and just, you know, get to that next level stuff.
That's one of my issues I have with, like, the singing shows, you know, like, look at the people that get through American Idol and win American Idol. They're perfect. They're robots.
Yeah.
You know, Paul McCartney's voice isn't perfect.
Right.
And look at, you know, freaking Bob Dylan and Neil Young. You know, these are guys that would have never even passed the first round in American Idol. But, man, they hit you here.
Yeah.
You know? It's the difference between listening to Neil Young shred a solo and Steve Vai shred a solo. I love Steve Vai. He's great. Actually, I could probably pick a better example for the shredders, but sometimes it's like, it's not all about precision. It's not a sport, man. You know? I understand where precision could come in handy when you're, you know, fencing or throwing a baseball into a glove, but it's not a sport. This is something you're designed. Music is designed to be entertainment. It's designed to inspire. It's designed to make you feel.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I, you know, music doesn't make me feel anything. It makes me feel like, you know, you're listening to sport. And it's just interesting because I also am part of a progressive rock project called Dave Kirzner Band, and we do all sorts of touring, and we play with people like Yes and Marillion, and we do these big things. And prog is kind of known to be a genre that's based on chops. Didn't used to be. You know, you listen to the first King Crimson album, you listen to the first Yes stuff, first five, six Yes albums, and it's there's songs there.
Well, know? Like ELO is like that to me.
Yeah.
They were kind of like the new window of that for me. It's like, oh, okay, arrangements. Oh, and they're taking it like one step further than the Beatles.
But there's songs there.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like once it started turning into a riff fest, and, you know, Rush kind of started it, but they still had songs. But after a while, it's just turned into this thing where it's like, you know, 40,000-mile-an-hour unison riffs, and, you know, and it's okay. It's cool. But, again, music shouldn't be sport. It should be, and you know, if part of making someone feel is creating a frantic situation where there's 1,000 notes, cool. But don't forget, you know, to leave something with the listener.
Yeah. So
somebody made a funny joke the other day. They said, what do rap fans whistle?
What's that?
What do rap fans whistle? You know? But I don't know. It's all good.
He's hating on the hip hop.
No, I'm not hating on the hip hop.
I'm just kidding. Well, let's get to one of the tracks on your record. What do you want to play us for, first?
Let's go ahead and play Spotlight Smile.
Okay. Here we go.
Spotlight Smile walks in the room. When she looks at you, you're a star. Let her in, into your world. This magic girl will take you far. Shine on me, shine on me. Won't you let it near to your heart, dear to your heart?
Totally had a yellow vibe.
A little bit.
And a little George Harrison type solo. Yeah. I like it, man. Very cool.
They call that power pop.
Power pop. No frills.
No frills.
In and out.
Yeah, fast.
No, that's, I love when songs have like really beautiful ornate arrangements and they're short. It's like it's got that Beatles thing. You got a lot of Beatles-esque changes in
Thank
there.
Thank you. A lot of the songs on this record clock in under 3. And I'm really proud of that. I love the economy of it. And I love being able to go in there and say something without boring the listener. You know?
Yeah, that's awesome.
A lot of filler.
And you know what? It's funny because you took an approach on the guitar solo that I really love. You were playing the melody, mm-hmm. which I'm doing a lot more of when I'm taking solos now, because it's like you're like, instead of playing this shredding guitar solo, you're like honoring the melody of the song by giving it a little bit of a showcase and a different texture. And I love that because I'm doing that myself. So I'm like, whenever I hear it in a song, I'm like, oh, I love it. It's so musical. Very cool. So what was one of the biggest obstacles when you're making this record?
Well, the first obstacle actually happened right before I made it. I had this opportunity of going to the studio and making the record, but I didn't have a lot of songs. So I had announced that I was going to make my next record, and I was going to record some new songs and some old songs, and basically, you know, give some old songs a facelift and then do this. And then I had a couple of people say, dude, don't be a pussy. All new songs. Write new songs. Hmm. And I'm like, okay, let me try it. So I kind of binge wrote most of the record, and there's not a single song on that record that's less than 6 months old, even at this point.
That's awesome.
So it's all fresh. But the biggest obstacle was showing up with songs that, number one, I still wasn't sold on and wasn't familiar with. And I was happy with them, but I was like, there was a little bit more of a, since a lot of these songs weren't road tested, it was a little scary to show it to people and be like, all right, check this out. Tell me what you think. And luckily, the reviews have been great. People have been really digging it. And it's a new approach. And it was really inspiring to sit down and sort of binge write. There's a song on my record called Look at the Moon where I was forced myself onto a couch with a pad of paper and a guitar. And I was sitting there writing the song. And my girlfriend texted me and said, look at the moon. And I was so busy doing what I was doing, I pulled up a live feed of the moon. And I was sitting there looking at this iPhone.
That's hilarious.
Moon and, you know, all the likes and the, like, hearts and stuff. And the song just came out.
That's crazy.
Exercised the song out of my head. Wrote the song. I posted a live video of me playing the song on Facebook. And then I got an email from some dude, and it's like, dude, I was jamming along to your song. I wrote a bridge. I'm like, oh, this could be bad. You know, because it's like, what do you tell a person? The song's done.
Right.
Well, I toyed with the idea of throwing it in there. I wasn't sold on it 100%. You know, I was like, okay, I think this song is done, but I will give this bridge a chance. I went to Memphis. I had some spare time before recording. I checked out his bridge, and I was like, man, this is perfect. Wrote lyrics to his bridge, and then that's the only co-write on the record. And the guy turned out to be Jordan Zevon, Warren Zevon's son.
That's crazy. I've
only met a few times, never worked with before, but he was so inspired by my song, he's like, I got a bridge for that.
I like that you're like, maybe.
No, well, you know, look, man, I am the father of this record. I got to make sure everything is right.
Yep.
And as much as I love collaboration, I've been in a situation where I've written with someone and it just didn't work.
Yeah.
And
I've been in many situations like that. It just happens.
Oh, yeah, man. In Miami and Nashville, even out here, there's a lot of the things where it's like, oh, we're not going to give you a chance until you co-write with somebody who's got a name.
Right.
And they'll put you in a room with somebody, and the first thing they'll say is, one progression all the way through. Let's make this sound like a cross between Coldplay, Daddy Yankee, and Tiesto. And I'll be like, I'm out. And it's not even so much about the Tiesto part. It's the one progression all the way through.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it doesn't always work. But, you know, in this case, it was magical. It was like, oh, man, this song is special. And I'd love to play it for you.
Yeah, let's hear it.
This song's called Look at the Moon. And it's co-written by Jordan Zevon.
Hey, look at the moon. Let's go out and look at the moon. You and I, let's let the moon shine on us. Hey, look at the moon. Go out and look at the moon.
Let's embrace and let the moon shine on us. And light our love.
Yeah, very nice. That's pretty. And I definitely like the bridge.
Thank you.
It's a good little breath. Breath of new chords, new sounds. Eddie's nipples got hard.
They did. They did.
I tell.
So let me ask you this, too. So when you were going through this record, was there like kind of like a cohesive story or kind of a theme that was binding for the whole thing?
The album cover was the theme. The album cover was taken before half the songs were written. And I set that as the theme of the record. I found out, actually, that some of the Yes album covers were painted before some of the music was completed, and they used it as inspiration for the general theme of the record. And there's a lot of cases where album covers were done before the music. And in this case, I wanted the album cover to represent the general vibe of the record. And it's a warm record with a lot of vibe. And there's a mystery. There's some mysterious stuff going on. And it's a generally loving record, whether it's songs about love or songs about, you know, falling apart of relationships. And this record was made at a very tumultuous time in my life, and there was a lot of change. And I was 100% happy when I made the record. I was getting there when I was writing the record. So it's the progression is there. There's some sad songs and there's some really joyous songs. So when I look back at this record in 20 years, I'm gonna smile because it was an amazing experience to write this record. All of the tracking was done in a day and a half.
Wow. Really? You
know,
all the instruments?
For all the instruments, I did vocals in LA. I did most of the vocals in LA, but I left Ardent with a completed record except for the vocals, a few bass tracks, and some sweetening.
So, Eddie, that's like, how long did it take you to do that?
It was 15 hours.
That is crazy.
Playing all the instruments, too.
Yeah.
So what I did is I set up.
You did like drum a scratch?
I came in with Pro Tools sessions with the tempos and the scratches and a scratch vocal. And I set up drum land, bass land, guitar land, keyboard land. And I just went in there, did the drums for all the tracks, did all the guitars, bass, keys. And I decided to leave the vocals to last because I'm not, you know, I work with so many incredible singers, and I'm not one of those. You know, I'm one of those guys that's like, I need to sit there and be in the right mood. It's got to be the right time of day. I've got to be in my zone. And I've become such a better singer since when I started. Because I'm naturally a guitar player, and I always imagined there would be somebody singing my songs. And then when everybody else kind of flaked out, I had to learn. And I had an incredible teacher, Beth Cohen, who's the backup singer for Barry Gibb in Boston. She was my vocal coach, and she taught me how to breathe. She changed the keys of some of my older songs, and she's like, you're a baritone. You're trying to write for alto. You're trying to write for tenor, and you're just not hitting the notes. And that she showed me about comfort keys. Like a lot of my songs are at E and A, and that's my comfort zone, E, A, and D, you know. Try to stay away from a lot of the higher keys.
Those are like the songwriter keys.
Yeah, they're good guitar keys too. G, but I've created a style that works, and I feel like this record has some of my best vocal performances, and a lot of it comes from hearing these tracks and going, "Damn, I gotta serve this."
15 hours, Eddie, too, is crazy to do a whole record in. That's just like a little bit ridiculous. So I'm impressed, Fernando.
I just came in with my game face on, and I was inspired. And there was some good coffee at the studio.
and we had say cocaine.
We had some incredible, say yes to no drugs. I had some incredible barbecue while I was there too.
Yeah, Memphis is the best.
Memphis is incredible. for food, and they have incredible chicken. But luckily, thanks to what's that chicken place from Memphis? Oh my God,
Gus's.
Gus's. Now there's two Gus's, and it's so good.
It is the best,
and it's just as good here as it is in Memphis. However, Ardent ain't moving. They're not going to open up Ardent West.
Well, are you touring for the record? Where can people find you?
Well, I just did my CD release party at the Hotel Cafe, but I just booked a date on the 25th of September. I'm going to be at Ireland's 32.
Where's that?
That is in Van Nuys.
Yeah, I used to stand up there. I used to, Monday night, there used to be a mic there. Yeah.
Eddie Montoya has a wonderful singer-songwriter night every Monday, and he's booked me for that. That's going to be incredible. And I am waiting on confirmation for another Hotel Cafe night. I love Hotel Cafe.
It's a great vibe.
It's a great vibe. I'm actually, I can say that Linda Perhex is having her CD release party on September 22nd there. Linda Perhex is an artist I produce who is well known for her album Parallelograms from 1970. I co-produced with Chris Price her first album in 44 years, which came out in 2014, called Soul of All Natural Things, which was on Sufjan Stevens' label Asthmatic Kitty. This album is called I'm a Harmony, and I co-produced it with Pat Sansone of Wilco, and it's going to blow some minds. It's got 4 out of 6 members of Wilco on it: Devendra Banhart, Nels Klein, Jimmy Poulter. It's a mind blower. And we're going to do the CD release party on the 22nd at Hotel Cafe.
Awesome. Fernando, and where can people find you on your website to buy the record?
FernandoPerdomo.com. Actually, FernandoPerdomo.bandcamp.com. Bandcamp is always the best way to get a local or independent artist's album, because you can name your own price, and they take the smallest cut, so we get the most money out of it.
And spell it out, because people are...
Bandcamp. Bandcamp. FernandoPerdomo.bandcamp.com.
Well, spell that out.
Fernando Perdomo, FernandoPerdomo. P as in Paul, E R D as in dog, O M as in Mary, O. bandcamp.com. You can also find me on iTunes, Amazon, and if you're a cheapskate, you know, Spotify and Pandora. But if you like it, buy it.
Right.
You know?
I agree.
And if you love it, tell your friends.
I love it. Fernando.
Thank you.
You were such a great guest. We're going to play a little bit more of your record on the way out, but we're going to have you back, man.
Oh, dude, thank you so much,
and
guys.
Amazing sounding guitar, by the way.
Oh,
man.
Well, this is my birthday gift. This is an Ovation from 1978. It's called a Balladeer, and my girlfriend Cindy bought it for me and surprised me with it. And what means a lot to me is that I received it the week Glenn Campbell died. I was a huge Glenn Campbell fan, and I saw his last show at
Staples Center?
No, it was at the Hollywood Bowl.
Okay.
That was one of his last shows, and he was well known for playing Ovation guitars. So this is Glenn, and his inspiration goes a long way. And also, funny enough, I was just reading about how Paul McCartney with Wings used an Ovation that Linda, his wife, gave him. So, you know, these are great gifts. They're wonderful instruments, and this one is super special.
Well, Fernando, you're a class act. On behalf of Eddie and I, we'll see you guys next week.
And thank you again to my manager, Ann Rinaldi.
Ann Rinaldi, yeah. We'll be right back.